Dog Works Radio is sponsored by Alaska Dog Works. Check out their website at alaskadogworks.com. Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mat-Su Valley. And I am joined today by our co-host calling in from California, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. We have, you know, it's been a very interesting off-season this year. We seem to constantly be having news, even though usually in past years it's been relatively slow around October and November.
You know, like we say, we always compare and contrast. I think the NFL wants to have a 365 league, and I think Iditarod is taking their goal with that as well.
Yeah, it seems so. And, you know, it's unfortunately, some of the news has not been great news, but it is always interesting for fans to be able to have news and to remind themselves of what's going on with the race and with mushing in general.
So we have a really interesting show coming to you guys here in just a minute, but we have three pieces of this news that we want to talk about. The first one we want to mention is about a longtime musher, Paul Gephardt. What do you have on that, Alex?
Yeah, so Paul has just announced that he is withdrawing from the 2018 race. He is battling cancer at the moment. This is obviously very sad, and we wish him the best. For people who don't know, Paul Gephardt is really just a great dog person. He's someone who is very devoted to the sport. He was instrumental in getting Christy Barrington into mushing and then her sister as well. So he's not someone who usually is thought of as being a strong contender, but a very, very solid, you know, front of the middle of the pack guy. And and also a very, very friendly guy and someone who is devoted to the sport. So we wish him well.
And it's interesting, he said that he felt some pain in one of his ribs, and thinking it was not a big deal, he went to the doctor, and the next thing you know, they diagnosed him with cancer. And it's amazing just how quick something like this can creep up on you, and it scares a lot of people real quick, doesn't it?
It does, and I think, you know, if anything, it hopefully will serve to his fans to not ignore these things. And if you know, it's better to have something checked out than to wait.
Right. Another piece of news is just a quick one. We mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about all of the controversies stemming around Iditarod, we mentioned that longtime musher Jason Mackey was charged with theft of some dog crates. And we're happy to report as of this week that those charges were dropped and all is well on the Mackey front, and there will be no charges pressed against those dog crates that he supposedly took from Nome and sent his dogs home in them and evidently did not return them. Do you have anything else on that?
No. I mean, as we discussed a couple weeks ago, there frequently can be some confusion about that. And so hopefully whatever it was has been straightened out, and people can go on and go forward now.
So the next piece of news just was released. I believe it was yesterday. We're recording on November 4th here. And the Iditarod made a statement online saying that they are going to increase security in Nome and install video cameras in the Nome dog lot. What do you have on that one?
Right. They're going to be, in light of the Dallas CV incident, there's been a lot of pressure on the Iditarod to increase security, and they have announced that they're going to be doing a number of things, including having surveillance cameras at the dog lot, presumably also, and Chaz St. George, who is the PR rep for the Iditarod, said that they may also have battery-powered cameras on each musher's sled. That would be turned on in the checkpoints so that you would always have some record of what's going on around the sled. Certainly that is a good step in the right direction. I think also we're going to see a lot more enforcement of rules and regulations and security, both at the start and the finish and in the checkpoints, that has been a little bit lax in the past. It's, you know, part of it is that the Iditarod is just a very long race, so it's hard to clamp down every inch of the trail. You know, we talk a lot about comparing the Iditarod to other sports. In a football stadium or a baseball stadium, it's relatively easy to secure the field and to secure the locker rooms and that sort of thing. When you're dealing with 1,000 miles of trail, most of which is way in the middle of nowhere, that's a much more difficult thing. So at least in the start, at the finish, and I think in most of the checkpoints, we're going to see people just paying more attention to security. In the past, it had been the case that people would come and go, fans would come and go in checkpoints and, you know, in around the start, around Willow and the Big Lake area, there would always be a lot of fans. And once you get past the first mile or two, it's pretty much open. So it's still going to be a challenge, but it's good to see that they are addressing it.
Right. I have two thoughts on that one. The first one, I did not hear about the cameras on the sleds. The only thing I would have to say about that is, number one, how reliable those would be, especially if it's a extremely cold race like it has been the last couple of years, and in particular the last couple of times where they ran from Fairbanks, where it was, you know, negative 50. I just don't know of any camera that that would function at that temperature, so that would be interesting. My other thought is, it looks like by taking this proactive approach that they are really sort of leaning now into the sabotage area. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they may be doing that, or they may just be, you know, one of the things that Dallas had called for was tightening up security and making sure that if this was sabotage, that, which he says it was, that it won't happen again. And so regardless of whether that incident was sabotage, it's a good thing to protect the mushers against this, especially now that we've had a lot of very public discussion of sabotage and ways in which, you know, the Iditarod and the dogs could be sabotaged. I think a lot of us who followed the Iditarod fairly closely have been aware of some of these issues for a while, but it's the sort of thing where we haven't really talked about them publicly because you don't want to give anyone who's a little bit unbalanced any ideas for how to do something that could be very, very harmful.
Right. All right. Any other news you want to mention before we jump into today's topic?
You know, just that one more thing about the cameras is that in addition to the issues of batteries, and batteries go out very, very quickly when it gets really cold, you also would pretty much need to have a very wide-angle sort of fisheye lens on the camera in order to make sure that everything would be captured. And even then, there is a possibility that there could be blind spots, so you need to have the sled positioned in a way that all of the dogs would be visible, or all of the equipment that's laid out would be visible. So while I do think this is definitely a step in the right direction, there's also a lot of issues that come with it, that this isn't a cure-all for, you know, for potential security issues.
And two other thoughts on that. One is, how is the footage going to be stored? Is it going to be on SD cards or something like that? And you have to worry about that type of failure. And secondly, you had mentioned that that wide view camera, that fisheye camera, even the best headlamps on the market, you know, the Lupine headlamps that are well over $1,000 a piece, do not reach the end of a dog team if you're standing on the back of a sled. So I would definitely wonder about the ability to capture the lighting. Maybe they would have infrared, sort of like those field cameras for, you know, for game coming into your yard, or, you know, deer and elk and that sort of thing. But that just seems like an interesting way to try to capture footage from the back of a dog team by using some type of camera. I just don't think anything like that is robust enough on the market to be able to do something that they want to do and do it well and be able to hold up if there was a problem.
And the other thing is, even though these technologies are getting better and cheaper year by year, this is still not an inexpensive thing to equip potentially 70, 80 dog teams with one of these cameras.
Right. All right. So let's jump into tonight's topic. You know, we have spent a lot of time over the last month or so on this show talking about doping in the Iditarod, and I listened to an absolutely fascinating podcast a few days ago by the producers at Outside Magazine. They talked about gene doping, and I tell you what, this could be the next thing, not only in human performance, but also with dogs. Do you want to start this off, or should I, Alex?
You know, I listened to the same podcast, and there's a great article also on Outside Online, and basically, and I'll start and then you can sort of jump in. Basically, there is a guy whose name is Josiah Zahner, and he is a former NASA scientist, and he started this company called the Odin, which stands for something. I'm not exactly sure at the moment what it stands for, but basically what he is doing is selling these do-it-yourself DNA hacking kits. He bills himself as a biohacker, and he's selling these kits that use what's known as CRISPR technology. And the way CRISPR technology works is that you have a – and this – I have to admit, when I first heard this, I thought this is science fiction. This has to be 20 years away at most, but this is something that actually is available right now that you could go out and buy online. And what these CRISPR kits do is they have a protein called the CAS9 protein, which cuts the DNA of a person or a dog, presumably. And then they have a tracker RNA, which will go and find the part of the DNA that you want to replace. So, for example, if you have a gene that does something, you could cut the DNA and replace it with another gene that does something else. And the example that one example that they talked about in the podcast was finding one of these jellyfish that has that glows underwater, and putting some of creating a homebrew beer that used yeast that had some of this glowing jellyfish protein put into the yeast. Other examples of things that you can do with this are to take, for example, a protein that will stop muscles from growing too much, and replace that so that specific muscles would grow even more. And you know, you can get a lot of these DNA things online for $60 or $65, and in some cases even less than that. So this is something that, although it seems very science fiction-y, I think is something that is going to really be a big, big issue, both in the Iditarod and in most other sports, you know, for the next few years, if there aren't people who are already doing this across all sports, I'm sure there will be, you know, within the next year or two.
You know, the future is now with this, and I found it so fascinating that they talked about being able to inject this this mutant DNA, this gene-doped formula into your body and immediately change something that is happening relatively quickly. Now, where this comes into play with dogs is even more interesting, and I think this is where we could have the tie-in with Iditarod, is they're already using this type of technology in dogs already, and it's important to note that they're using this at the embryonic stage of a dog's development. They are using this type of gene-crossing technology in Alabama, I believe it is, a breeder of Dalmatians is taking genes from a different source and including them in his embryos of his Dalmatian future puppies to cure breed-specific disorders such as deafness and other types of things. So it is definitely changing the way that these dogs are being developed. And, you know, human implications aside, I think that there is a lot of interesting things that could be done with dogs. And in particular, of course, we're talking about the Iditarod dogs and how this could change the way that the Iditarod is ran. Because, as they were talking about on the podcast, if you inject this one particular gene or protein sequence into the embryos of Iditarod puppies, and you talked about that explosive muscle growth or that growth that does not stop, it just continues on. Just think about unlimited endurance. Thinking about some of these Olympic weightlifting folks, you know, just pure muscle. Just imagine that on a sled dog, or just having the endurance of nonstop ability, and then injecting that type of gene in with an embryo of a sled dog puppy. Not only does it affect that puppy, but it now affects every offspring from there on out. So it would affect those dogs, and then of course their offspring, then their grandchildren or their grandpuppies, I guess, and then on and on and on. It would be a cyborg puppy, and I think that is an interesting concept when we're talking about Iditarod. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a couple of things. First, dealing with embryos is a much more effective way because of the way the technology is at the moment. If I were to inject this into myself, it would affect the cells that are where I injected it for a little while. So it wouldn't affect my entire body. And apparently, if you do this on a developed person or presumably dog, it has an effect for a limited amount of time over a limited amount of space. But if you do it at the embryo stage, which, no one is talking about doing that with humans, although I'm sure people are tempted to do that or will be tempted to do that. But if you do that with a dog embryo, then you are basically changing the DNA of the dog that will last, it appears, for the dog's entire life. So that's something that is both very profound and a little bit scary. You know, there are lots of potential unintended consequences with that. If you take away the protein that stops your muscles from growing, or that stops the ability to sense pain, for example, you could potentially run until your muscles destroyed themselves, or until you literally dropped dead. And so I think that's kind of the nightmare scenario, is we're not, even though we've isolated a lot of these DNA strands and we've been able to pinpoint certain things and where they are controlled in the DNA sequence, there's just a lot of things that we don't know. And so for every potential use, like breeding out deafness in dogs, or breeding something that could, fight cancer or fight AIDS or something, it seems like there are 10 or 12, other things that might happen and go wrong that frankly worry me.
You know, there's an absolutely fascinating study of a group that they're doing over in Russia with a group of silver foxes, I believe, and they're teaching these foxes how to become more docile or more puppy-like. And it's taken generation after generation after generation of very controlled breeding and handling for these dogs to be able to be much more puppy-like and much less wolf-like or fox-like. And with that, it's taken, I believe, something like 30 or 40 years to develop those strains where you have either absolutely aggressive dogs by dogs, meaning these foxes or wolves, by breeding only the aggressive ones together, or the absolutely docile ones by having only the most docile dogs together, you know, a very controlled breeding environment, which is what most people are doing today with modern dog breeding. They're taking out what they see as the best trait in one dog and then putting it together with the best traits of another dog to equal, hopefully, the best traits in the puppies. But when you're dealing with something like this where it could be almost immediate, where you inject this substance, this gene strand or this protein strand into an embryo, and then all of a sudden you have this super puppy, it is a way of doing something that does not take many generations. And as you know, a dog can have a litter of puppies potentially two times a year. So you could have a relatively good idea of what you're dealing with in just about a year compared to what these guys are doing in Russia, which is very interesting. But as they said on the podcast, Alex, right now, of course, there's lots of ethical concerns with this, but there's no way necessarily to beat it. And I know this is where I want to tie it together with the doping that we talked about in Iditarod, and now we're talking about this gene doping versus drug doping and how it could come into play into endurance sports like Iditarod, the Yukon Quest, or any other type of dog endurance sport. If somebody got a hold of this and wanted to do a program like that, they could literally produce a super dog in, you know, a matter of a season and a half. They could have a dog on the trail that was developed in this quote-unquote lab, and then have these super dogs on the Iditarod Trail in just a couple of years. That's a very interesting prospect to me, and I think that's why I wanted to talk about this today. Aside from the ethical issues, what do you think the thoughts are? Do you think somebody would go this route to do so? I know we probably wouldn't say yes, last year before all of this controversy developed, but I think just about anybody, including in Iditarod or just about any other sport, will go to whatever extreme necessary to win at their particular sport. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you are absolutely right. And, you know, some people will say this is just the next step, a more technical way of doing what people have done for years, which is just naturally breeding the dogs. You know, it's you're changing the way the dog lines go based on your breeding and how you select different dogs for breeding. This is very clearly a different thing. Part of the problem that I see is that, as far as I can tell, there is no way to test for this. There's no way to ascertain that this has happened in a particular dog or a particular human athlete. I believe in almost every major sport, it is illegal to do this, or it is against the rules to do this. But it's very, very difficult to catch someone if they're doing this. And the thing that was most surprising to me about this whole topic is that you can just buy one of these kits, like the starter CRISPR kits, I think are $150, and then you can buy the protein that you want to change the DNA for $60.
Right.
So I wouldn't be, I mean, certainly no one will, I don't think anyone will admit to doing this, but I would not be at all surprised if we saw someone trying to do this, you know, within the next couple of years.
I don't think we'll see it. I just think it will happen. And I think that's where the interesting part of it, at least on an ethical standpoint, comes from. I think that, especially if it's relatively inexpensive, if you could do this for you know, maybe even a couple of $1,000s, if that's what it took. That's a relatively small expense to set up a quote unquote super dog team that would have just an absolutely extreme example of what the dog is able to do on one of these races. So what do you think about the ethics of this, Alex? I know folks have been asking us over the last couple of weeks if we can do a show that is dedicated to sports ethics, but what do you think the ethics part of this is, at least in your opinion, as a fan? How do you see this sitting with your community, not not the mushing community as a whole?
My gut reaction to this is that it's wrong. I can't quite put my finger on why it's wrong or where exactly the line should be, but just on a gut level, this just seems clearly wrong to me.
Right. And, you know, we've talked a lot about on this show about teams having access to funds that other teams don't. You know, that's just the nature of sport. I know we talked a lot about that when the two-way communication and the coaching was allowed on the Iditarod Trail. And we said that, the more professional teams or the teams that have more funds would be able to utilize that rule more than the folks that are a little bit more budget crunched. They would have that a little bit more in the fanny pack, so to speak, to be able to do things like this. And I think, as we mentioned, it would definitely not be without reach of one of these top teams to be able to do something like this. I just wonder how many folks have been dabbling in the quote unquote sled dog laboratory to do things of this nature. I've never heard of it, but I was just excited to talk about this on the show after hearing that podcast. And like you mentioned, I went back and read a couple of articles on it as well. And I just found it real interesting. So my last question to you, Alex, is if you had the ability to do something with one of these gene kits, I know they talked about it on the podcast where at some type of conference or whatever, they took this jellyfish gene and injected it into his forearm or something like that, and immediately it reacted into the speaker's forearm and it glowed with a black light or something like that. Would you do something like this, whether it be for fun or from all seriousness, meaning being able to cure a disease or a sickness or some type of an inheritance deal? Would you dabble in this CRISPR technology?
I don't think I would unless it were a very, very serious health issue. And even then, I think I would really be hesitant just because there's so much about it that we don't know. When you first asked it, my initial reaction was, well, I'd like to be able to do something that would make my hair not go gray.
Right.
But then I thought, oh, that's really ridiculous because they have hair dye. So I think I could do without, changing my DNA.
You know, my last thought on this is, in the last few years, things like this have just exploded on the market. Now you can, do a swab with a Q-tip and send it off to Ancestry.com or 23andMe or whatever and get an entire profile back in just a couple of weeks that will tell, where you're from and potential health risks that you may have and all these sorts of other things packet that you can buy at Target. I had my wife do it. I bought her one for her birthday, and I just picked up the packet, and it was shipped to her, and she sent it in. And within a few weeks, she found out what nationality she was mixed with, et cetera, et cetera. But you can also do this with health risks, and you can do proactive type interventions to cure or to kind of ward off these types of illnesses or diseases. And it's very much the same thing, but in that instance, you're finding markers versus changing the genes themselves. I know they have that available for dogs. And I remember a couple of years ago, we did an interview with the founders of a company, I believe it was called Blanket ID, and they talked about this, I want to say like 3 or 4 years ago here on the show, and you could probably find it in our archives, about how you can send this in for your dogs, and they will tell you, okay, well, you know, this dog may look like a golden retriever, but it's also, you know, a little bit of a pug and a little bit of a Labrador and a little bit of a German Shepherd. It's just so interesting what you can do these days, even though it's 2017, things are happening very quickly. And as we had talked about just a couple of episodes ago, this could be a new indication for the new Iditarod. What are your final thoughts on this? And then we'll close.
You know, the one thing that I'm thinking is if someone in the next few years, in the next 3 or 4 years, just comes out of nowhere and is an amazing competitor, I think there's going to be a bit of a shadow on him or her, because people are going to think, not necessarily, oh, this is a great, these are great dogs and this is a great dog person, but I wonder if this is a genetically engineered team. So that's another thing that we're going to have to worry about in the future.
And then we will have, as they had in Major League Baseball, the steroid era, and they have all those asterisks on, you know, Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and all those, you know, major records that they broke during the steroid era. I wonder if this were to occur in Iditarod or other sports, if we would have an asterisk era of Iditarod with, you know, all of this gene technology emerging. So what I encourage folks to do over on our social media pages, you can find us searching by DogWorks Radio on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whichever. What are your thoughts on this new technology and the potential for gene doping in the Iditarod? That's what we're going to call this show here. I would be interested to hear what most people have to say. And I think that it could be something that we're talking about in the near future. I think that we're definitely the first ones to cover this, at least on a podcast format, in regards to sled dog sports. Have you heard it anywhere else other than this Outside Magazine article on any other podcast, Alex?
No, I haven't. And the Outside Magazine, the article is from September 6th of this year, and I believe the podcast is even more recent, is from the end of October.
Right. All right, Alex, it's been a pleasure, and we'll talk to you guys next time here on Mushing Radio. Goodbye.